All right, buckle up, everybody, because today we are going way, way back to the final years of the Kingdom of Judah.
Yeah, fascinating period, really.
It really is. We're talking crumbling cities, we're talking about clashing empires, and of course, we're talking about archaeology.
That's right. And the archaeology really brings it to life, doesn't it?
It does. It brings it to life. It doesn't just tell us what happened. It gives us those human stories. It lets us actually connect with the folks who were living through this incredibly tumultuous time.
Yeah. And, you know, when we talk about sources, it's not just archaeology, right? We've got ancient texts. We've got incredible visual record, especially from the Assyrians.
Those reliefs are just out of this world. They're so detailed, so vivid.
Yeah. They really give us a sense of what it was like to be there. So I think to kind of set the stage for this deep dive, we need to talk about the big bad wolf in this scenario, the Assyrian Empire.
Oh, yeah. These guys were not messing around.
Yeah.
I mean, their military machine was just terrifyingly effective.
Absolutely. And, you know, it wasn't just about brute force. It was about psychological warfare. They were masters of it.
Yeah. I mean, some of the stuff I've read about their tactics, it's the stuff of nightmares, you know, impalement, flaying people alive.
Oh, absolutely. And they'd use their enemies' bodies as building materials. They wanted to create this aura of invincibility, of sheer terror.
So it was all about just crushing their enemies, not just physically, but also psychologically.
Exactly. Break their spirit. Imagine you're holed up in a city, hearing whispers about what the Assyrians do to those who resist.
I don't even want to think about it. It must have been absolutely terrifying.
Chilling, yeah. But I guess there's a silver lining, so to speak, to this brutality.
Oh, how so?
Well, it leaves behind an incredibly rich archaeological record. I mean, their violence, as horrific as it was, helps us understand their campaigns in incredible detail.
So it's like a twisted kind of historical irony. Their brutality is what allows us to study them so closely today.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. And this brings us to a very specific event that really captures that Assyrian brutality. Sennacherib's siege of Lachish in 701 BC.
Ah, yes, the Lachish reliefs. I mean, these carvings, they're just like a window into that siege.
They are. Unbelievable detail. Siege engines battering down the walls, defenders fighting back, captives being marched away, even scenes of punishment.
And what I find incredible is that they're not just artistic impressions. I mean, scholars actually believe that the artists were there, on the ground, documenting what they saw.
Absolutely. And the archaeological evidence actually backs up a lot of the details in the reliefs.
So we're not just looking at propaganda. It's like a visual record of this incredibly brutal event. I mean, even with all that, the defenders of Lachish, they didn't give up easily. They tried to build a counter ramp to hold off the Assyrians.
Desperate, desperate measures. But here's something really interesting. Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, he brags about all these cities he conquered during this campaign, but there's a glaring omission. Jerusalem. He right. never claims to have captured Jerusalem.
Wow, that's a huge omission. So despite facing this terrifying siege, Jerusalem somehow managed to hold out.
Seems that way. We don't have all the answers, but it really makes you wonder what happened. What happened within those walls?
It's a mystery that I guess we're still trying to solve.
Absolutely. And it wasn't just about surviving sieges, right? Judah was also trying to function as a kingdom, trying to maintain some sort of order amidst all this chaos.
Yeah. How did they even do that? I mean, with everything going on, it's hard to imagine how they even kept things running.
Well, that's where these LMLK jars come in. Thousands of these large storage jars found all over Judah. They're like these little puzzle pieces that archaeologists are trying to fit together.
They are incredibly distinctive. Those unique shapes, the inscriptions, like ancient postal codes almost.
Yeah.
And that rosette symbol, it's like their official seal.
They really stand out, don't they? And that's what makes them so intriguing. What were they used for? Taxes. Royal supplies. Maybe even part of King Hezekiah's preparations for war. There's a lot of debate, but it shows a kingdom trying to stay organized, trying to keep things running smoothly under incredible pressure.
Yeah, it's like these jars are more than just containers. They're like a window into how Judah's administration functioned, even in the face of this existential threat. And what's also fascinating is how the markings on the jars actually change over time, going from fingerprints to these more elaborate stamps, like their bureaucratic systems were evolving.
They were refining their methods as they went, always adapting, always trying to find a way.
It's incredible. Oh, and then there's the mystery of Memshat, this inscription that's mentioned, but no one knows exactly where it refers to.
Some archaeologists think it might be a lost royal estate somewhere near Jerusalem. Imagine finding that.
Talk about a hidden treasure. But hey, you know, we've been talking about all these amazing discoveries, but I think it's important to remember that archaeology isn't always a straight line to the truth.
Absolutely. It's a process. And sometimes Even the most brilliant minds can get things wrong.
Yeah, like William Foxwell Albright, this famous archaeologist. He made a major blunder with a seal, misattributing it to the wrong period. And that mistake, it actually threw off the dating of all sorts of artifacts for decades.
The Albright misattribution, it's a classic example of how important it is to be careful, to be meticulous, and to constantly question your own assumptions.
Because even the experts can fall prey to confirmation bias.
They can. It was only much later that Olga Tufnell, through her incredibly detailed study of pottery from Lachish, helped correct the dating.
It's a reminder that archaeology is constantly evolving. We're always learning, always refining our understanding of the past.
Exactly. It's a journey, not a destination.
So we've talked about kings and empires and sieges, but what about the everyday people living through all of this? I mean, what was life actually like for them?
You know, that's what I find so compelling about archaeology. It's not just about grand monuments and battles. It's about the lives of everyday people. And excavations in Jerusalem have uncovered some remarkably well-preserved houses from this period.
Like a time capsule.
Exactly. One house in particular, the House of Ahil, it's like stepping back in time. And get this, it had indoor plumbing.
No way. Indoor plumbing in ancient Jerusalem.
Yeah. A stone toilet, a cesspit.
Yeah.
It gives us incredible insights into sanitation and daily life.
It really humanizes it all, doesn't it? Makes you realize that they were dealing with the same basic stuff we do, just in a very different context.
Absolutely. And then there are these burned bullae, these little clay seals that were attached to documents.
Like ancient wax seals.
Exactly. And because they were burned, they were preserved. They're like these little time capsules offering glimpses into people's lives right before the city fell.
It must be incredible to hold one of those, knowing that it was touched by someone who lived through these events, someone whose story we're still trying to piece together.
Yeah, it's a tangible connection to the past. And speaking of tangible connections, there's one discovery that really shook the world of biblical archaeology.
You're talking about those tiny silver scrolls, right? The ones found in a burial cave outside of Jerusalem.
Yes, Cave 25 in the Kitef Hinnom Cemetery. Initially, they were almost overlooked, but when they finally deciphered them...
And the way they were deciphered is just mind-blowing. It involved a group of kids reciting the priestly blessing.
It's an incredible story. And the inscription on the scrolls... It turned out to be the priestly blessing, one of the oldest known biblical texts, predating the Dead Sea Scrolls by centuries.
It's like holding a piece of history in your hand, a direct link to the faith and traditions of Judah before the Babylonian destruction.
It's a powerful reminder of the continuity of these traditions, how they endured even in the face of such upheaval.
It gives me chills just thinking about it. But of course, as much as we find these glimmers of hope, we can't forget that the shadow of destruction still looms large. We need to talk about Nebuchadnezzar II, the king of Babylon, and what happened next, because this is where we see the end of an era. Nebuchadnezzar's campaigns, they ultimately led to the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC, and the archaeological evidence, it paints a very stark picture.
Layers of destruction, arrowheads, shattered fortifications. The city was devastated.
But wait, there's a final twist to this story. During some renovations at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, they discovered these ancient cedar beams. And get this, their dating is actually controversial.
Yeah, some experts think they could be from Solomon's temple. Can you imagine?
Remnants of one of the most iconic structures in biblical history, hidden in plain sight. It's mind-blowing. We've gone from the brutality of Assyrian warfare to the intimacy of ancient prayers, maybe even a piece of Solomon's temple.
This deep dive has been quite a ride, hasn't it?
It has. But the story doesn't end there. In the next part, we're going to delve into the aftermath of this destruction and explore what happened to Judah and its people after the fall of Jerusalem.
Because even amidst the ruins, life finds a way. And archaeology continues to challenge our assumptions about what happened next.
Wow, so we've just explored the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians in 586 BC.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a turning point. But what happened after? I always kind of pictured it as this empty wasteland, just, you know, crickets chirping.
Yeah, it's easy to imagine it that way, right? Just a desolate landscape.
But I'm guessing it wasn't quite that simple.
You're right. It's a common misconception that the land was totally empty. But both the Bible and archaeology, they tell a different story. Remember that cemetery we talked about, Kitef Hinnom, where they found those silver scrolls?
Yeah, the ones that might have belonged to a priestly family. What about it?
Well, archaeologists have found evidence that it was still in use after the Babylonian conquest. Well into the 6th century BC.
Really? So people were still living in Judah even after the destruction of Jerusalem, even after the exile?
Exactly. Life went on even under Babylonian rule, and not just in Jerusalem. We found artifacts, pottery, even seal impressions from this period all over Judah.
So there was still a significant population. Wow, okay. So what was life like for them? Did they just become Babylonians overnight?
Not exactly. The Babylonians, they appointed governors like Gedaliah, but they didn't force a complete cultural takeover. It's interesting, though, the capital of this new province, it wasn't Jerusalem anymore.
Oh, where was it?
Mizpah, further north.
Wow, so Jerusalem is destroyed, a good chunk of the population is deported, and they move the administrative center to a totally new location. That's huge.
It really is. And this brings up another fascinating detail. When the first wave of exiles returned from Babylon, you know, under Zerubbabel, decades later, they had no problem figuring out where the temple had stood.
Huh, that's interesting. I guess I never really thought about it. I mean, they would just know, right?
Yeah, you'd think so. But think about it. Jerusalem's in ruins. Decades have passed. It makes you wonder how they knew exactly where to go.
You're right. I mean, I guess the remains of Solomon's temple would still be visible.
Exactly. Plus, many of the people returning, they were children when they left. They would have still had those memories, you know, coming back as adults.
That's powerful. They wouldn't have forgotten their most sacred site.
And in fact, the Bible even talks about how some of those who remembered Solomon's temple, they wept when they saw the new, more modest structure that Zerubbabel built.
It must have been such a bittersweet moment. Joy to be back, but also grief for what was lost.
Yeah.
It's incredible how these events continue to resonate, even after all these centuries.
It really is. It speaks to the enduring power of memory, of place. And it reminds us of the Babylonian period. It wasn't some static period, you know. It was a time of change, of adaptation, and ultimately of the Neo-Babylonian Empire's decline.
The Neo-Babylonian Empire. You know, I always forget there were different phases of Babylonian power.
There were. It's actually a pretty short-lived empire, all things considered. Roughly from 612 to 539 BC.
So what happened? Did they just, like, disappear one day?
Well, no. They were conquered by the Persians, led by Cyrus the Great. And that's where things get really interesting, especially when we think back to that idea of Judah being completely empty after the Babylonians.
Yeah, you said there was evidence that people stayed even after the destruction of Jerusalem.
Exactly. So that raises a really important question. What role did those who stayed behind play in the return to Zion, you know, in the rebuilding?
Oh, that's a great point. We tend to focus on the returnees, but what about those who never left? What happened to them?
That's something archaeologists are still trying to piece together. But there's evidence of continuity, you know, in pottery styles, burial practices. It suggests that there was a blending of cultures between those who returned and those who stayed.
So it wasn't a simple replacement of one population with another. It's like a whole other layer of history that we're just beginning to understand.
Exactly. And that's the beauty of archaeology. It constantly challenges what we think we know. It reveals new perspectives, new stories.
Yeah, it's been a recurring theme in our deep dives, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
From Albright's blunder to those silver scrolls, every discovery seems to push us to rethink what we thought we knew.
It's a process, a journey of uncovering the past.
So we've gone from Assyrian conquests to the Babylonian destruction to the complexities of this Babylonian period and now this Persian era on the horizon.
It's a lot to take in. And the story of Judah, it doesn't end there. The Persian era brings its own set of challenges and transformations, its own archaeological mysteries.
And I'm sure plenty of surprises along the way.
Yeah.
All right, so we've gone from the Assyrian war machine through the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem, and now we're in the Persian period. What's the vibe now? Is it all like rebuilding and happy endings?
Well, it's definitely a time of major transition, you know. The Persians, under Cyrus the Great, they were actually known for being relatively tolerant rulers.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Especially compared to, like, the Assyrians and the Babylonians.
Absolutely. And in fact, Cyrus, he actually issued a decree allowing the exiled Judeans to return to their homeland.
Oh, yeah, the decree. Remind me about that.
So it's recorded on what's called the Cyrus Cylinder. It's this clay document, and it's actually been called, like, an ancient declaration of human rights.
Wow. The Declaration of Human Rights. Way back then.
Yeah. And it's pretty remarkable that something so fragile actually survived all these centuries.
It really is. So this cylinder, it basically gave the Judeans the green light to come back, to rebuild Jerusalem, to rebuild the temple. What was that like?
You know, it was a period of hope, for sure, but also immense challenges. We have this fascinating account from Nehemiah, who was appointed governor of Judah.
Nehemiah, yeah.
And he faced a ton of opposition. You know, neighboring peoples, they weren't exactly thrilled about the Judeans coming back and rebuilding.
So it wasn't just a matter of picking up the pieces and starting over. There was still a lot of conflict, a lot of tension.
Absolutely. I mean, Nehemiah, his story is like a political thriller, economic hardship, internal divisions, you name it. But he also oversaw the reconstruction of the walls of Jerusalem.
Oh, wow, the walls. And it must have been a massive undertaking.
Yeah.
What does archaeology tell us about that?
Well, archaeologists have actually found sections of those walls that date back to the Persian period.
No way, really?
Yeah, and they match the descriptions in Nehemiah's account. It's amazing to see those physical remnants of their determination to rebuild, even in the face of all that adversity.
So the temple is rebuilt, the walls are back up, there's a new administration in place. Does that mean Judah is back to, like, its former glory?
Well, not quite. I mean, things were different. Judah, it was still a province within the Persian Empire.
Oh, right, right.
So they had to pay taxes, navigate imperial politics. It was a new reality.
So it's not a simple happily ever after ending.
No, it's more like a slow and probably at times painful process of recovery, of adaptation.
And of figuring out this new world they found themselves in.
Exactly. And it's a process that's still being revealed, you know, as archaeologists continue to dig to discover new evidence.
It strikes me that history isn't just about dates and names and battles. It's about real people, real stories, real struggles.
I think that's a really important point. And through archaeology, we can touch those stories. You know, we can connect with those individuals who lived through these incredible events.
So we've gone from those early Assyrian conquests through the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem, the challenges of the Babylonian period, and now this emergence into the Persian period. It's been quite a journey.
It really has. But for me, what stands out is that resilience. You know, the resilience of the human spirit.
That's a good word for it. Resilience.
We see it in the resistance at Lachish, in those silver scrolls, in the rebuilding of Jerusalem. It's a powerful message, and it resonates even today, thousands of years later.
It's a reminder that history, it's never really over, is it? It's a conversation that continues as we uncover new evidence, as we find new ways to connect with the past.
I like that, a conversation. The story of Judah during this period, it's not just about destruction, it's about the complexities of human experience, the power of faith and culture.
And the enduring legacy of the past. This deep dive has been incredible. I feel like I've learned so much.
Me too. And who knows what amazing discoveries are still waiting to be made.
That's what's so exciting to all our listeners out there. Keep exploring. Check out those Lachish reliefs online. Maybe do some reading about the LMLK jars or dive into the story of those silver scrolls. There's a whole world of history out there waiting to be discovered.
And remember, archaeology is always changing. What we think we know today might be challenged tomorrow. That's what makes it so fascinating.
So keep those minds curious and keep exploring the past. Thanks for joining us on this incredible journey.